From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. For the past couple of weeks, I've been holding down the fortnight for vacationing Terry Gross, who returns next time. And looking at the scheduling board, there's some good conversation ahead. Today, we talk with the other set of eyes behind the cameras of Eraserhead, Dune, Blue Velvet, and Wild at Heart. Cinematographer Frederick Elms shoots movies for David Lynch and other directors. We'll learn how he works. Lynch's movies are vicariously scary. My other guest, Doug Peacock, has real-life scary encounters with grizzly bears. He tracks, part for catharsis from his experience in Vietnam, and in part because he wants to save these endangered and deadly animals. Also, Prince, no knave on the rock scene, issued a new album. Rock critic Ken Tucker honors us with some Prince. And Mark Halliday is back with another poem. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Iraqi news agency reports tonight that the wives and children of American embassy personnel stranded in Baghdad will be allowed to leave. The U.S. government has not confirmed the report. Iraq had detained the group of Americans in a bid to force the closure of the U.S. embassy in Kuwait. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The latest announcement came at the end of a day filled with uncertainty. Iraqi troops surrounded a number of foreign embassies in Kuwait City as the deadline for closing the embassies approached, and the Iraqis changed the deadline. The U.S., Canada, European nations, along with Egypt, defied the order, and diplomats in Kuwait City prepared themselves for a siege. The U.S. government said it was a symbol of our rejection of Iraq's illegal annexation and occupation of Kuwait. There were other reasons, too, to provide help for the 2,000 Americans who remain stranded in the country. Many embassies have been sheltering Westerners and others from the roundup by Iraqi troops. Iraq has given new details on who can leave the country. Only wives and children of diplomats are allowed out until the embassies in Kuwait are closed. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
Reports from Kuwait now say that at least 9 foreign embassies are under Iraqi guard. A European envoy said Baghdad has threatened to use force to remove the diplomats remaining in the embassies tomorrow. The Iraqis are also reported to have threatened to cut water and power to the missions. The Speaker of Iraq's parliament said today that the presence of U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf might ignite a war that could set the region and its oil fields on fire. He threatened that thousands of Americans could be killed. Jordan today attempted to keep pace with the changing events in the Middle East. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Today, Jordan reopened its borders with Iraq and called on the International Red Cross for assistance in helping at Ruwaisha. Jordan said that now it should be able to handle up to 20,000 refugees a day. But Turkey, also inundated with refugees, warned its borders with Iraq might have to close. King Hussein received Austrian President Kurt Waldheim today. They are holding diplomatic talks aimed at freeing trapped Western hostages. Tomorrow, Waldheim will fly to Baghdad to talk to President Saddam Hussein. Jordan also tonight reported that it will close its embassy in Kuwait, but it gave no further indication that it would move the embassy to Baghdad as requested. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
The State Department announced today that it's providing $1 million to help Jordan deal with the influx of refugees pouring across the border from Iraq. Spokesman Richard Bauscher said the money would be put at the disposal of the U.S. embassy in Amman. Part of the money's been earmarked for tents to house refugees from Iraq and Kuwait. Bauscher said the U.S. is also working through the International Red Cross, which has a unit operating on the Jordanian border. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained more than 49 points today to close at 2,532.92. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sej Thompson. The show comes from Philadelphia, a city that inspired David Lynch, in fact, still does. He often excoriates the city and says it shaped some of the weird and goofy and horrible images of Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, and Wild at Heart. But the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce should understand that Lynch lived across the street from the city morgue. The other influence integral to David Lynch's vision is my guest, cinematographer Frederick Elms. Since his 20s, Elms has collaborated with Lynch, creating startling and vivid film images. He's also shot Lynch's Dune and Tim Hunter's River's Edge and Martha Coolidge's Valley Girl. Elms and Lynch just shot some new perfume commercials for Opium and Calvin Klein. The cinematographer is the crew member that actors must trust most because he's the one who shows them to the rest of us. The cinematographer is sometimes called the director of photography. When Fred Elms goes to the movies himself just to watch, he likes to sit in the center, down close, where the image is larger than life and the sound is loud.
My first movie experience was were shooting home movies. My dad had a 16mm Bell & Howell camera, and he wasn't afraid to let me use it, and he got me some film, and I took pictures of our vacations. We went to Alaska, and I took some movies of it, and I had a real good time doing it. It really stayed with me. I brought the film home and edited it and put together a movie. Quite an epic, I must say. I'm sure it was over an hour long.
Wait, and what was your reaction when you first saw it up there on the little silver screen of your home?
It was great. I was in awe, I think. I kind of didn't realize that it was so easy. It really had a magical sense to it, and I think I hooked into that right away. I looked at it again, and I had to go back and edit some more, and that really got me started. I couldn't stop after that.
When did you meet up with David Lynch?
I met David Lynch about 20 years ago when I first came to Los Angeles. I shot a film called Eraserhead that David directed, and we've really stayed in touch and shot movies together ever since then. So we were both in our early 20s, and we worked on that film, and we really developed kind of a visual communication style that makes working together with him a real pleasure.
Whenever I see one of David Lynch's movies, I'm struck by the melding of the visuals with the music and the sound effects, and they seem more cohesive than in many other movies. And I wonder, when the two of you are working together, are you conscious of how a mix might go or what might else would be added to a scene?
David and I are always very conscious of where the scene is going and what the outcome is likely to be in the finished film. I mean, you never quite know what all the details are. However, David is pretty easy to talk to about where a scene goes in a film and how it fits and what the music might be for that scene. In fact, we often sit and listen to music before we've even shot the scene. We talk about the mood and the feeling, and that includes the kind of music composition, the overall tone of the scene, whether it's light or dark, the mood that's created by the lighting, as well as the locations and all those other things. So we have a pretty good picture ahead of time. It's, in a way, it's a little like pre-visualizing as much as possible from the written page.
I've noticed in looking at a lot of the David Lynch, Frederick Elms collaborations, a strong use of earth tones, browns and greens and oranges, a lot of sort of dark and unusual color palette. How much of this is incidental to the scene, to what you're just happening to see right there, and how much of it is you go into the movie saying we wanted an earthy look?
Well, I think with David and I, it's not by accident. It's something we've talked out ahead of time. David comes from a painting background and is very, very conscious of colors in the frame, and that's also something I like to be able to control as well. So we're both very conscious of all the colors that are out there. So we really do it by design completely.
In Wild at Heart, what I see is our establishing shots are actually extreme close-ups of a match being lit, a bit of a fingernail. This seems almost to turn the idea of the establishing shot inside out. And is this the function of what you're trying to do?
I never thought about it consciously, but that makes a lot of sense. It really does turn things around. It starts with the very, very closest shot first, closer than you would see, you know, with the human eye, really, because we've really put the close-up lenses on the camera and moved right into it. But we have used it effectively in starting the scene off, and it acts as little connecting links and connecting elements and kind of, sets a tone for those scenes. So I think you're right. It has done that pretty effectively. It's turned things upside down.
When I saw one of those matches on the screen, which appears as big as a sequoia in 70mm size, how close was it actually to the lens when you were shooting it?
Well, those match heads were between 2 and 3 inches from the lens. It was a real trick to get them in there, get the camera in that close, and not get not get burned.
A scene in Wild at Heart that I found especially hard to stomach and always reminds me to floss was looking up into Laura Dern's and William Dafoe's teeth during a scene in which William Dafoe as Peru, Bobby Peru, is sort of threatening her. And filling the wide screen are these two mouths, sort of looking right up into them. Mm-hmm. Where did you have the camera to get that shot?
Well, again, we had it in very, very close to them. I really feel strongly that if we use a normal or a wide-angle lens on the camera and push the camera closer and closer to the actors, that we have a sense of immediacy on the screen, that a telephoto lens really distances the camera and therefore distances the audience from the action a little bit. So whenever I can, I put a little wider lens on and I push right up close. So I think we were, 6 or 8 inches from their mouths. I mean, we were really pushing right in tight there. And I think that's what helps give it some of the power. We really needed the power out of that, and I think we got it pretty well in that scene.
Do the actors then have to stand in an odd position to make room for your camera?
Well, sometimes they do. The actors are real professionals, and they're pretty good at that sort of thing. So they're good at standing in the right position and not moving too much, but moving just a little bit in order to make it sound like seem like convincing action. But there are certain technical limitations, and they really help us out a lot.
What kind of equipment do you favor to help get these effects?
Well, the equipment I use is pretty much standard equipment in the motion picture business. It's available to everyone. There really aren't any trick lenses or trick machinery we use. We often use close-ups in Wild at Heart, and they may be a little bigger than other people's close-ups, but really it's not so hard to do. I think you just have to think of where to put it and what makes sense in the story. It's not really the equipment that does it for you. It's your design going into it.
Mm-hmm. How do you protect your equipment from blood spray and all the gory scenes?
Well, we use lots of plastic. Lots of plastic, Visqueen, and a piece of Lexan in front of the lens, so in case something comes our way, we're shielded from it. We're very careful with the safety aspect, fortunately it doesn't have to happen too many times in the schedule, so we all get through it okay.
Some of the scenes in Wild at Heart are truly gory, and part of them they're enhanced by, I think, the quality of sound as you hear one character's brains being bashed out. When you shoot these scenes, do you feel any kind of queasiness about them? Or is it just special effects or just a frame shot that you're interested in there?
Yes, I feel a sense of goriness about it. It really is affecting. I think it affects everyone who's sitting there watching the shot. Certainly on one level, I have to deal with how the shot is framed and whether the light is right and whether we're making a shot that cuts into the next part of the scene. However, I always tap into the emotional part of it automatically. It just comes immediately for me, and I think that's part of an indication for me of whether we're getting what David is looking for in the scene.
There's a road scene in which Nicolas Cage is driving with Laura Dern sitting beside him. They're at either side of the car. Windshield wipers are going, and they're roaring down the road. Where were you perched to get this image?
Well, I was in a precarious position. I was out on the hood. So when we do those shots that involve dialogue or close-ups in cars, there's several different ways to go about it, but usually it does involve in some way strapping the camera securely to the hood of the car and then putting some lights out on the hood of the car. And oftentimes putting the operator, that would be me, out on the hood of the car, and then towing the car with a large truck in order to make it safe, so that Nick Cage, the actor, doesn't have to think about driving the car and not running into oncoming traffic, as well as working on acting and doing lines at the same time. So it really is a process. It's something you kind of learn to do, and it's kind of fun actually shooting cars.
Because you have the wind in your hair, or,
what? Right? You have the wind and the rain in some cases.
My guest is cinematographer Frederick Elms. His new film is David Lynch's Wild at Heart. Elms was also the cinematographer for the Lynch films Eraserhead and Blue Velvet, and he's worked as the director of photography for River's Edge, Valley Girl, and The Killing of a Chinese Bookie. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cinematographer Frederick Elms. Comparing two movies that you've shot, one, Blue Velvet, directed by David Lynch, that has lots of color in it, and The River's Edge, directed by Tim Hunter, that has very little. Is this a function of you, the director's point of view, the weather?
Well, it's a function of speaking with the director and finding a style that fits the story. For me, the story really comes first, and I would hate to think that two films I shot looked just the same. I really would try to find a style and a technique to photograph a film that would give it an individual feeling and would really fit. So Tim Hunter and I had conversations about River's Edge that were quite different than my conversations with David Lynch about Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart. So that's the root of the difference in style. It really is a communication with the director about how he or she sees the story.
So the intent in River's Edge was to have a grayer, flatter look of light to it?
Right, right. Our aim was to make it softer, to make it rather naturalistic, to not have hard, sharp shadows or sharp edges too much, to make it on the cool side, to stay away from sort of warm and friendly things, but to go toward a blue or an overcast feeling whenever we could. So we kept that in mind when we, you know, made the lighting for the scene and chose the locations.
You have a lot of experience through working on The River's Edge and with David Lynch in filming dead people. Is there anything you have to do differently as a cinematographer to film dead people than live people?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. Well, fortunately, they're not really dead.
Right.
You know, fortunately, they really do get up after the shot. I know that the woman who played the body in River's Edge was most convincing, and she had me scared a couple times. And I just don't know how she did it. We were out there shooting in January, and even though it was Los Angeles area, it was darn cold on those you know dewy mornings, and she just froze out there. But she did a real good job, and I think that, you know, that's what I rely on is you know, someone who knows what they're doing in that position, and also, you know, a realistic sense of makeup, a realistic sense of what happens to a body when you know, when life passes from it, and what do we get from there?
How do you capture? Do you want to light it differently? I mean, there's the horizontal dead body of the River's Edge, and then there was the dead body actually standing up at one point in Blue Velvet before he toppled over.
Right. It's funny. I think the inspiration is a little different in each case. I know for River's Edge, Tim Hunter had this idea that there are some Edward Weston photographs of nude women that inspired him in placing the body, in finding a spot on the river's bank that that felt right to him, and also in not hedging, in not being afraid to show a body naked because it was such an integral part in the story. So I think his inspiration came from those photographs, and we looked at them together, and that really helped me get a handle on just what direction he was going in. And in that case, it was a matter of making the light feel very natural and very soft, you know, to make her look quite dead. The feeling in Blue Velvet was a little different. It was a very surreal sort of room. It was a scene at the end of the film where you just you're sort of seeing it through the young lead's eyes, but you don't really know what he's seeing. You don't really know what's happened in the room, and you investigate with him as you walk into the room. So that's a kind of a different situation.
You have a reputation for making wonderful-looking films, such as Valley Girl and River's Edge, on relatively small budgets. Is this considered a desirable quality in Hollywood, or would you like to be associated with big-budget productions?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know, because I haven't done any very, very big-budget productions. I've done the smaller films and feel really good to think that I could make them look in a sort of a cohesive and coherent way on less money. I like the idea of working with certain limitations. I think limitations make you stretch and make you work, you know, for what you do. You know, if you have a scene that takes place in a location and you're in a house and the room is just a little bit too small because you couldn't afford to build the set, you find ways around it that are often more interesting than if you were working on a soundstage with a set where you could take out all the walls and do it like they do in the big movies.
There's a scene in Wild at Heart where people come upon a traffic accident at night in a desert.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely dark all around.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get the feeling of the scene just being illuminated by car headlights.
Mm-hmm.
How did you plan that?
Well, that one was actually pretty easy. We knew it had to be dark. I mean, that was the underlying theme of the scene, to make it as dark as we could and still see just enough to make it, you know, a very emotionally wrenching, you know, kind of accident. So we found a big empty stretch of desert road, and it really was empty. I mean, there was just nothing out there at all except for these Joshua trees. So we found a place to put, you know, one big lighting source, and then all the rest of it was really lit from the headlights of the overturned wrecked car. And that, you know, we took our cue from that. If somebody walked out of the light, they got dark, and if they walked back into the light, they got really bright. And that seems to have been the key. I know that's a scene that always gets me, even though I've seen the film a lot of times now. I get a little shiver, you know, every time on that one.
It's a disturbing scene. Much has been made of David Lynch's power to disturb, to frighten, to just be weird. How much of this is your contribution?
Well, I'd like to think that a lot of it is. I of course, that's my ego speaking, but I think that I'm really just a part of it. It's a team effort making a movie, and certainly David is at the helm of the ship, and David is the inspiration for the power of those scenes. However, it takes all of us working together. It takes, you know, me figuring out what the camera does. It takes, you know, a lighting and grip crew to make that all possible. And it also takes, you know, an editing and a sound crew. I sometimes look at Blue Velvet, and there's a very powerful scene where the Dennis Hopper character takes Kyle out for a joyride at night in a car. And it's kind of a horrifying idea to begin with. But the combination of the camera and the kind of spooky lighting and all the darkness in the frame and all the sound really makes it the scene what it is. I think if you watch the scene and turn the sound off, you have a very different impression. So those bits of sound and the driving music and the road noise and so on and so forth really heighten the reality like 1,000% or so.
When you have a disagreement with David Lynch, what does it tend to be about?
Well, David and I actually don't usually disagree about too much. We have been working together for quite a while now, and we really have a way of doing it that's it doesn't really involve much disagreement. It involves kind of refining things. David has an idea, and I say, well, you know, what if we did it this way? And he says, no, that's all wrong, but, you know, that's a good idea, and what if we tried, putting one of these in? So it really is it's a matter of give and take. It's not anything clean, hard cut about it. I know there was a scene in Wild at Heart where Nick and Laura are in a motel room at the end of the film, and it's real dark. It's the Texas Motel, and there were things. There was a scene there we rehearsed, and we actually I think we shot a take of it, and it wasn't really coming together. That the scene wasn't sort of rising up and becoming real for David. So David threw us all out of the room and sat there for a little while with the actors and worked it through again and came up with a new variation on it. And then he came to me and said, well, look, Fred, you know, I've got this little variation and it's a little different scene now and it really has a feeling going for it. And the lighting that we did isn't really it's not going to work anymore. So we got to come up with something new. And what I think is, what if we imagined the power went off in the motel and they had to bring in this big fluorescent light, and there's this big fluorescent light in the room, and that's all that there is. That's all that's lighting the scene. And it's got this kind of mood and feeling about it. I don't know what it is. And then I said, well, gee, what if the lighting wasn't, what if the light didn't really work, if it was kind of flickering and it had an odd kind of flicker going on it? And he said, yeah, maybe that's the ticket. So we built this fluorescent light and we set it there by the bed and gave it a little flicker. And, sure enough, it's one of those things that helped give the scene a whole new feeling. It really helped the actors and David bring the scene to a new level.
That's that vertical light to the
right,
side of the bed.
It's that one.
I looked at that, and I thought, I've never seen a light like that in a motel room. What is that?
Well, we built that just for that scene.
Huh. Do you have difficulties working with a flicker, with the frames of the film going by? Do you have to time the flicker in any way?
No, actually, we kind of worked it out so that it would look right. I mean, it's a little trick you do, but it's really pretty simple. And we knew that if we could make it look right by eye, that we'd have it on film. And the advantage was that it would help the actors. That the actors, kind of use that as a device to put them in a different space as well.
Do you still make home movies?
I do sometimes. I have a little daughter who's 2.5 years old, and I have the greatest time making videotapes and pictures of her. She's one of the best documented kids around.
Do you get any sort of weird effects in there?
Well, actually, I do. I have this wide-angle lens I like to use. I'm not sure she's going to appreciate that when she gets to be 16 or so, but I'm having a fun time with it now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
My guest has been cinematographer Frederick Elms. His new film is Wild at Heart. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, rock band Los Lobos. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. When Doug Peacock left the war in Vietnam, he sought the sanctuary of the North American wilderness. There he found a presence bigger than his recurring nightmares, the North American grizzly bear. Coming up, Doug Peacock reflects on the humility he learned in the wilderness and his encounters with the fierce grizzlies. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the album we're hearing, As I Now Speak, Graffiti Bridge, music from a new movie by Prince. And we'll have a few minutes of poetry from our house poet, Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As two deadlines passed, Iraqi soldiers made no move outside the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. In what could be a hopeful sign, Iraq said dependents of foreign diplomats could be evacuated. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Some 20 embassies are staying open in Kuwait, even though Saddam Hussein has demanded they shift diplomatic operations to Baghdad. The United States is keeping about a dozen diplomats at its embassy. About 100 American diplomats and dependents went to Baghdad, where they were detained in what the Bush administration called a duplicitous reversal of an Iraqi promise of safe passage. One of the deadlines was noon, the other midnight Kuwait time. After they passed, and the soldiers kept patrol at the U.S. embassy, Iraq announced dependents could depart after all. However, the U.S. was not officially notified. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
2 days after closing its border to Iraq, Jordan has opened it again, and officials say that 20,000 people a day will be allowed through. Officials in Jordan had defended the closing by saying tens of thousands of refugees flooding into the country had put an impossible strain on facilities since the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Soviet President Gorbachev today warned Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein that he must abide by UN Security Council resolutions or else face the possibility that the UN will take additional measures against Iraq. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's message indicated that the Soviet Union may now be ready to support a new UN resolution authorizing limited use of force to enforce economic sanctions against Iraq. Up to now, Soviet officials have expressed concern about the military buildup in the Gulf and urged more political consultations to resolve the crisis. But Gorbachev's message appears to acknowledge that force may be needed to make Iraq comply with UN demands. The Soviet president called the Gulf situation extraordinary and extremely dangerous. He urged Iraq to comply immediately. Otherwise, he said, the UN Security Council will be forced to take additional steps. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
A UN Security Council meeting is slated for tonight in New York City. The Soviet ambassador to the UN says it's his country's intention to vote in favor of a U.S. proposed resolution to use military action to enforce the UN embargo against Iraq. The Soviet ambassador said, however, that the Soviet Union wants to review the text. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 49 points to close at 2,532.92, volume 199 million shares. Advancing issues edged out declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with Vietnam vet Doug Peacock. He came home from the war, retreated to the woods to heal. He then chose to track and live amongst the grizzlies. But first, Prince has issued a new album, Graffiti Bridge. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews it for us.
Everybody wanna see you down for the cunt. Everybody being a real man's bone hanging around for the kill. So the bigger the hole, the bigger we feel. They can hit us with all they got, but you know what?
There's a pretty simple reason why Graffiti Bridge is as good as it is. To paraphrase the words of that song, which opens the album, he can't stop the feelings he's got. Of all the major rock stars, Prince does the best job of creating artful music that sounds thrown together, almost spontaneous, and always full of primal emotions. Graffiti Bridge is ostensibly the soundtrack to his forthcoming film of the same name. It's also the best collection of songs he's released since Dirty Mind in 1980. I don't know what the movie of Graffiti Bridge is going to be about, and frankly, I don't expect much, given Prince's preening, feeble film career thus far. But I can figure out what Graffiti Bridge is about as music. Freedom. It's Prince's sometimes blunt, sometimes evasive manifesto about creative, sexual, and by implication, political freedom. New Power Generation, the cut I just played, spells that out. Prince identifies himself with his audience, a real first for this intensely self-absorbed artist, and then tells everyone outside that audience to stop judging, stop meddling, stop censoring. Prince is demanding the freedom to make a simple, sexy song like Tick, Tick, Bang.
You're such a pretty tease. You get me all excited, and then you go home. You like ice cream. I got to get you before you all go. You're such a bombshell. If I ever get you, ever get you, then we'll tell them how long I last. Bang all over you. Bang, bang all over you. Bang, 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 bang.
In 1988, Prince almost put out something called the Black Album, but he withdrew it at the last minute. Bootleg copies revealed the Black Album to contain lots of heavy breathing, a scattering of four-letter words, and thick slabs of funk music. He'd conceived the album as a dense homage to Sly Stone and, especially, George Clinton. The reasons Prince held back the Black Album have never been confirmed. It might have been because he'd just put out another album, Sign of the Times, or more likely, he felt the warm, moist breath of the Parents Music Resource Center panting down his neck. The funk on the Black Album, however, has now been matched by Graffiti Bridge's collaboration with Clinton, a duet called We Can Funk. Although Prince sings and performs most of the music here all by himself, other guests pop up on Graffiti Bridge. His colleagues and co-stars The Time provide a few of their own songs. 13-year-old Tevin Campbell sings a duet, and most pleasurably, Mavis Staples of the Staples Singers performs a Prince confection called Melody Cool.
They call me Melody Cool.
One song on Graffiti Bridge is called Joy in Repetition, and that's the secret of this album's artistic success. In the past, Prince has tended to fail whenever he indulged his fondness for Rococo arrangements and philosophical musings. With this release, however, he's constructed most of his songs around simple, straightforward musical hooks, These soul, pop, and funk grooves gain force and wit from slight variations he applies with each repetition. It's the elegant way he deals with simplicity that makes Prince a deeply satisfying, complex pop artist.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Everybody wants to fly Graffiti Bridge. Something to believe in, a reason to believe that there's a heaven above. Everybody wants to fly Graffiti Bridge. Everybody's looking for, everybody's looking for, everybody's looking for love.
This is Fresh Air. When Doug Peacock went to Vietnam in the late 60s to serve as a Green Beret medic, he carried with him a small road map of Wyoming and Montana. He'd pull out the battered map to overcome homesickness and to recall his beloved mountains and canyons. Back from Vietnam, he found an antidote to his war experience in the wilderness. He was awed by his chance encounters with the grizzly bears. In his new book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness, Peacock writes, "The grizzly carried physical strength and thorniness of disposition that allowed him to attack or kill most any time he cared. But almost always, he chose not to. That was power beyond a bully's swaggering." Since then, Peacock has spent years tracking the grizzlies. For a while, he filmed them. Peacock said he didn't go looking for the grizzlies. They found him.
I just happened to be out of sorts, like a lot of other vets, and I went and essentially lived in the wilderness because that's where I was comfortable. I went back in the Rocky Mountains and I sort of camped by myself, and I didn't really have a conversation with anybody outside of give me a beer or fill it up for, well over a year and a half. But one of those places I camped, there were grizzly bears around. And one thing that you do in grizzly country is you pay a lot of attention because you're living with one animal on this continent, which if it chooses can kill and eat you. And what it allows you to do is really get outside yourself, because self-indulgence is just impossible in grizzly country. And that's exactly what I needed. I really needed to somehow step outside of my life and look back on all of that which had been my life in Vietnam for the past 2 years. And the grizzly is a very, it demands all your attention. And when you live in grizzly country, you walk with humility. You're really a second-rate citizen. And that attitude of humility, I find, is a very useful one, because it's really the emotional posture behind reason, you know, that receptiveness.
Is this attitude of humility one that you also felt when you were serving in Vietnam?
Well, that happens to be true. I'm not sure if the reasons are related. I was way out in the boonies in Vietnam, and my experience was a bit different from other GIs in the same era, mainly because I was never around any Americans. I worked on little Green Beret teams that were always understaffed, and there might be seven or eight of us on a team, but all day long I would usually only spend maybe an hour with Americans. And when I went on combat patrols, it'd be normally two Americans, but occasionally I even went with just all by myself, and I would be the leader of a platoon of all mountain yards and Vietnamese. And I did this for well over a year. And, you know, after a while, it was kind of hard who I was and what I wanted to be. And so I had sort of an odd experience over there. I spoke Vietnamese, and I spoke enough mountain yard to hold a very primitive sick call, at least. But, you know, I would go maybe 6 weeks and hardly have a conversation in English. So that was a perspective that I just don't know anybody else that's lived it and written about it yet.
What do you carry when you go into the woods with you in search of grizzlies?
Well, I just take what I need to live on. You know, what you need to keep warm with, including a tent and a sleeping bag. You carry snowshoes if it's a spring, and a little bit of food. I don't carry much food because Like Jim Harrison, I'm a tad burly, and I can usually sort of metabolize for about 10 days without being in any trouble. But also when I'm out there, I try to live like a grizzly. You know, this time of year when the berries are ripe, I take a little bag of granola or sampa, but basically I eat huckleberries, you know, just like a grizzly bear. And just like a grizzly bear, you know, it's very healthy eating, you know, 5 quarts of berries a day. You end up, you know, with 2 giant piles of scat at the end of every day, whether you choose to or not.
You first went out in search of grizzlies in part to help purge yourself of some of the, I guess, nightmares of your time in Vietnam. Do you still have those nightmares?
I have them, but they're different. They've evolved a bit. I would say, incidentally, I have just as many dreams of bears as I do Vietnam, and my dreams of Vietnam are not terribly nightmares of combat. They're just as apt to be. Just dreams about the countryside, because Vietnam was a beautiful place, and I loved the highlands, I loved the people that lived there. And the same with bears, except grizzly bears in my dreams can be quite terrifying. And, you know, that's interesting, because when I'm out on the ground with grizzlies, I don't feel afraid. I think the fact that I haven't been chewed on or mauled or even touched by a grizzly bear and I've had, you know, several dozen close confrontations at 10 or 15 feet. Probably, I think, I'm glad that I ridded the fear in my dreams rather than taking it out in the woods with me.
What was your most terrifying close encounter with a grizzly?
Well, I wouldn't say it was terrifying, because something else, the terrifying just never happened. But there's one place that I'm going to go in about 5 days up in northern Montana where grizzlies gather in great numbers to eat huckleberries. There's no people there. Nobody ever goes in there to look except myself and a few people that have gone with me. But they form a social hierarchy, not unlike bears do at salmon streams. It's a little more subtle, but that's what it is. There's one big bear. It's a big, presumably male grizzly. I call him the black grizzly. When he comes in, all the other bears, even though they've been feeding on berries for weeks, they just begin to leave the range. Some years when he's cantankerous and really nasty, he virtually charges everything that moves, and that mainly means other grizzly bears. Well, one night I was on a ridge filming grizzlies, and a storm was blown in, a snowstorm, and there was a sow with a little cub grazing up the side of this steep ridge in thick brush, and below her, I saw this black grizzly come out and start to browse up the same hillside, and she hadn't seen him yet. And just as the sow reached the ridge in front of me, and this is a naked ridge, and it's only about 100 feet in front of me, this male grizzly that I call the black grizzly, the really the dominant creature of the social hierarchy, spotted her, let out a bellow, and charged flat out. And the female and her cub raced across the ridge right in front of me, and the black grizzly closed on the cub. And incidentally, the male grizzlies are the most dangerous thing outside of human beings to little bears. And just as the black grizzly was, his jaws were just inches below this little cub, the mother spun on her heels and met him with her jaws, and these two grizzlies went at it. You know, the female grizzly protected her young, and the black grizzly that outweighed her by 200 or 300 pounds. And they slashed and bellowed. I'd never heard sounds like that in all nature. And this is all happening about, 70 feet in front of me on this naked ridge. And it's between me and the camp I've got to get to. And it's almost dark by then. And this fall blizzard is blowing in. And anyway, I thought the black grizzly was going to kill a sow. Well, she stood him off, and they stood nose to nose, bellowing at each other for seconds or possibly even a minute and a half. And then the sow sort of backed off, and the black grizzly turned its side, and bears do that when the fight is over. And then the black grizzly came back to the ridge maybe 50 feet in front of me, and it just stayed there and started to pretend to browse on huckleberries. That's called displacement behavior, but whatever it's called, it really didn't matter, because I had, you know, there was nothing I could do. I had to face down this bear, and I had some bags in my hand. I sort of decided I was going to make a move on him, and I started talking to the grizzly, and he hadn't noticed me before then. And I started walking towards him. When I was about 50 feet away, maybe 45 feet away, he looked up at me and took a couple slow, stiff steps towards me. And I don't really remember actually what I said, but I think how you say it is much more important. And I had my head turned off to the side, and I talked to this bear, and this bear walked up perhaps 20, 25 feet from me, and its ears were back and its roach was up, and I just knew I was going to get it. And then suddenly, just as this charge would have taken 2 seconds, the black grizzly flicked his ears and turned his head off to the side and went down in the brush and disappeared maybe 20 feet away. And I raced by, got to the top of the hill, got my little camp, built a little fire, which I never do up there because I don't like to spook the bears. And it was dark by then. And within 25 minutes, I could hear this grizzly coming up the side of the hill. And I'd get some fire brands burning and go off to the side of the hill and say, "Hey, black grizzly, it's only me up here. Why don't you give me a break?" And the bear would come up within 20, 30 feet and then back off. And then an hour later, he'd come up another side of the ridge. And this went on until 2 in the morning. And by then, I found myself shaking uncontrollably like I hadn't done since I was strafed by the 101st Airborne in 1967 in Vietnam.
If most of your memories have been purged in part by going after the grizzlies, what keeps you going back? Is it the danger of encounters such as that?
Well, I couldn't deny that because I'm sure that's what attracted me to grizzlies in the first place, and it still does. It's that danger married to great beauty. I mean, grizzly is the most intelligent, the most human-like of all American beasts, and they're also dangerous, and I can't separate those elements. But as far as my experience in Vietnam, Vietnam sort of solidified my doubts. I was not a person that changed his mind about the war. I didn't think it was good, and I was just one of those person so perverse that I had to go see for myself. I have to do that no matter where I am and what I'm involved in. I have to check it out for myself. And so that's I did all that. But I think my instincts were right, and I've carried those all the way through. And one of those is that grizzly bears are really important. And in my sort of twisted way of looking at things, saving grizzly bears is a really radical idea because you just can't save grizzly bears without transforming, the whole aspect of the American culture that put us in Vietnam. I mean, we just aren't going to be able to do that again. And what's going to say, what you learn from the grizzly is not just what is dangerous and what is dominant. What you learn from the grizzly are lessons of restraint. You know, being around grizzlies really teaches you a reverence for life more than anything else.
Doug Peacock, thank you very much for being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Doug Peacock's new book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness, is published by Henry Holt and Company. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, and host Linda Wertheimer has stopped by to give us a preview of today's report. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Sedge. We're following the story of the embassies in Kuwait City. The United States and a number of other countries' embassies remain open. They are ringed by Iraqi troops today. We'll have reaction to that from the American president. The United Nations is close to a decision on how to enforce the embargo against Iraq. We'll look at Operation Bright Star, a rehearsal for the war which is looming in the Persian Gulf. And we will talk to some reservists who are being sent to Saudi Arabia.
Thanks, Linda. We'll look forward to that full report later on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. Our poet in residence, Mark Halliday, stops by our poetry tent to read for us today. He says this poem is about how a sense of happiness depends on a sense of its opposite.
Life's bounty. Hungry at midnight, you open the refrigerator in a dark kitchen and wow, Shangri-La. The green and red and orange foods in their cartons and jars, olives, juices, chocolate syrup, yellow butter, brown bread, and back by the blessed blazing bulb, leftover spaghetti sauce with latent power in its deep Mediterranean redness. As life goes on, there will be times when I feel that a sudden alertness to life's bounty, e.g. food, is enough to make a poem, a celebration sort of poem, and I'll write it and feel okay about it, but it won't be a poem that really matters to me or you, because interesting truth, like interesting pleasure, is so triple-edged and marbled. It's so mixy. Either the snack you fix turns out to be stale, or you're thinking about your father's anger or your spouse's bad luck or your next job, and you don't quite taste it. Or the snack is delicious and you eat it and then it's gone, and soon you go to sleep. What we need is some complication of the idea of life's bounty, how its mixiness is actually inseparable from our sometimes loving it, the thrill of joy being that you know the joy is both unlikely and temporary. If you could fully have your way, it wouldn't stay your way for long. How did Wallace Stevens put it? He said, "Delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds." I love being able to quote those lines. I love the fact that they're his and not mine, while I worry that mine are nothing next to his, while I worry that he wouldn't admire my use of them. And when you love seriously, you love something, a dog, a poem, a lover or friend, for being more independent and complicated than your selfishness would have planned. Now, the personal example I'd have expected myself to give at this point might have involved a love affair, quote, "and when I watched her slide out of bed at dawn, ... But I was just remembering a dinner at Mike's Gourmet Fast Foods with Annie and Peter and Peter's 3-year-old niece, Katie. I had a mocha frappe, 3 scoops, with the 3rd scoop floating, a Swiss burger, and an order of fried mushrooms. Katie grew tired of her large vanilla cone much too soon and wanted to ramble. One of us had to keep tabs on her, while the other two chewed fast so we could take her home from the too exciting drive-in and coax her towards sleep. I'm not good at chewing fast. I try to savor things. The dinner quad dinner was thus not wholly satisfying. But I like the memory, the whole memory. Annie laughing when she caught Katie's scoop barehanded as it fell from her upended cone, and Peter resisting being charmed by his nuisance niece as she stood on the hood of our Fiesta and danced and sang, "I Don't Want to Go Home."
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries. The show's all edited and mixed by Roberta Shorrock and Allison Dufty. Terry Gross returns next time. She has a splendid staff that helps put Fresh Air together. It's a privilege to be with them and with you. Thanks. I'm Sedge Thompson. Safe journey.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, new music from Los Lobos. Also, detective writer Walter Mosley. His hero's a black private eye trying to make it in a white world. I hope you can join us next time on Fresh Air.